This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. If I were to tell you that today's show is all about Hail Marys, you'd know what I mean, right? Just to be sure, let's do a quick rewind.
Penalty marker is down. Play is stopped. One thing is certain. Those brave folks who sat out here in the Orange Bowl and put up with this terrible weather saw a whale of a football game, and they should give both teams a rousing ovation when this one is over.
November 23rd, 1984. Doug Flutie and the Boston College Eagles are down by 4 to the University of Miami Hurricanes. A field goal won't cut it. Hope is all but lost. Play resumes with just 6 seconds on the clock.
Flutie flushed. Throws it down. Cut by Boston College! I don't believe it! Oh. It's a touchdown! The Eagles win it!
It's a 63-yard bomb into the end zone for a touchdown. Around here, folks sometimes call that pass the Hail Flutie. But in sports, a Hail Mary can be any sort of last-ditch effort. An idea so crazy, nobody thinks it'll actually work. And this week, we have 3 Hail Mary stories. First up is an unlikely bit of sports lore we unearthed a while back in an equally unlikely place, the annals of avant-garde art rock. You might remember the band Devo, best known for their 1980 hit Whip It and for wearing flowerpot-looking hats and yellow hazmat suits on stage. They were weird. But weirder still is the story of how an equally colorful athlete wound up being a kind of mascot for the band. Reporter Sean Cole explains.
To understand what happened, you need to know that Devo has a pretty considered philosophy, and that is that the human race is in a state of de-evolution, hence the name of the band. Their songs are about things like corporate control and blind conformity, and they were visual artists first, before they even wrote any songs. This was in the early 70s in Akron, Ohio. So one of the founders, Jerry Casale, says they were always trying to figure out what devolved art would look like.
You know, because we were very, very enamored and put off at the same time by pop culture, like the lowest end of like ad graphics, terrible TV commercials. So we're walking through the Kmart.
Nope, it was the predecessor to Kmart. It was Click.
This is Mark Mothersbaugh, another founder of the band. I should probably mention here that this was more than 4 decades ago, so a lot of the details are fuzzy for folks. Anyway, they're in the department store.
We were looking for supplies. We were collaborating on a visual art piece together and walking through the sports section.
And there's these 6 practice golf balls in a clear plastic pouch, sealed shut at the top with a cardboard display head.
The kind that you hang on a metal hook. And on that display head is an illustration of the smiling face of the renowned golfer Chichi Rodriguez.
I saw it and I just loved it. It was a picture of him in front of a golf ball.
So his head's kind of haloed by a big golf ball.
Kind of imitating something that I'd already been printing, which was human heads in front of the moon, and it made us laugh.
We chuckle. We have to have that. And of course, golf was almost symbolically like the most lame kind of, you know, bourgeois pursuit that you could have, especially at that time. Unless your parents were rich, you didn't get to go golfing.
If we ever imagined ourselves on a golf course, it was probably as a caddy.
And how boring it looked then on TV and the announcing.
Yeah.
But the one guy who stood out was Chichi because he didn't fit with the rest of the golfers at all. He wore these loud pants and bright shirts, and he had this famous hat that only he wore, which had a specific hat band and, you know,
the Panama hat.
Straw, yeah. Panama kind of hat, yeah.
So they took the package home. Mark used the picture in a self-published manifesto he was writing about being a quote-unquote spud boy in the rubber town of Akron. But other than that,
nothing really happened with it until we were already putting out our self-produced single, Be Stiff. Somehow, and I don't really remember the moment, but we had the idea of putting Chichi on that cover.
On the cover of the 45. Be Stiff was a kind of jokey anthem, celebrating the literal stiffness, uptightness, of politicians, televangelists. So using that image of Chichi on the cover was a kind of comment on commercialism and America's obsession with selling.
And in this case, selling plastic golf balls and the Americana of the golfer.
Be Stiff came out in 1978 on Stiff Records. They wrote the song well before they signed with the label. And it was distributed in the UK, where not as many people were familiar with Chi Chi. And then about 4 months later, Devo got its big break. Warner Brothers signed the band for their first full-length album. And that, says Jerry, is when the real de-evolution began.
Okay, we've laid that whole thing out and working up to this moment, and then comes the real Devo twist that only a corporation could provide. In other words, what we're talking about, we become part of.
This new album had the very long title of Question, Are We Not Men? Answer, We Are Devo. Jerry and Mark and the others thought, since the picture of Chi Chi worked so well on the Be Stiff single, let's just stick with it and put it on the cover of this record. The guys worked with the Warner Brothers art department, getting everything mocked up and ready to be approved for production.
And then about 2 days later, we get this call, and it's a big crisis.
The call was from the vice president of business affairs for Warner Brothers.
David Berman, who was a guy that you would cast in a movie about the music business.
As the villain or as the hero?
Well, it just depends on your point of view. He was very smart, very good at what he did, and played hardball. And the first communication is, I'm a golfer, and I'm a fan of golf, and I know Chi Chi Rodriguez. I've met Chi Chi Rodriguez. You cannot use Chi Chi Rodriguez.
That is completely and totally false.
This is David Berman. I told you not everybody's memory is crystal clear regarding this story.
Not only have I never met, I have never seen Chi Chi Rodriguez other than on television.
I'm not going to make fun of a friend of mine.
I've never met him. I've never spoken to him.
I'm not going to get this company sued.
That part is accurate, says David Berman, about maybe being sued. Yes, he did play hardball, but he says his objection was purely a legal one.
Purely. And California law is crystal clear. You can't use somebody's name or likeness for commercial purposes without their permission. It had nothing to do with my being a golfer other than because I was, I knew that it was clearly Chi Chi Rodriguez. But it wasn't the fact that he was likable. It could have been Rory Sabatini and I would have done the same thing.
Wait, who is Rory Sabatini?
He's a golfer.
Uh-huh.
But nobody likes Rory Sabatini.
Also, Rory Sabatini was born in 1976 and would have been 2 years old when the Devo album came out. Anyway, Jerry Casale says this was a total shock to the band.
We're dumbfounded and crestfallen. We don't know what to do. But of course, we're stubborn. We're not giving up.
So Devo decides to write Chi Chi Rodriguez a letter to formally ask his permission. But the way these things work, as soon as the record company starts spending money, they want to see a return on their investment. Plus, Devo was scheduled to appear on Saturday Night Live less than 2 months after the record was released in August of 78. So if production was late, no album to promote. Meanwhile, the band had another idea, involving another piece of de-evolutionary art.
It's an artist rendering of what the last four presidents would have looked like had you combined them.
So Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford all mashed together. It was a picture Mark Mothersbaugh had lying around.
And it was this hideous, bizarre face that had John Kennedy's hairline, and it had Lyndon Johnson's ears and Richard Nixon's nose.
So the band brings that image to the Warner Brothers art department.
On an idea that why couldn't we just mutate Chi Chi's face so that it isn't Chi Chi anymore?
It was like building an old Mr. Potato Head toy. They grafted Johnson's ears and Nixon's nose on Chi Chi's head, reversed the mouth. David Berman from Business Affairs doesn't even remember this, that the image was altered. So I sent him the original Chi Chi image and the potato head collage so he could compare.
Looking at it today, I wonder why I approved it, because to me it still looks like Chi Chi. But obviously I must have.
Jerry Casale.
And about 3 weeks later, a letter comes back from Chi Chi's representatives.
No.
Saying, yes, Chi Chi thinks it's fine to use that image. He just wants 50 records at Christmas time to give out to his friends and family.
He wanted to say to his friends and family, like, look, I'm on a record.
Right. He liked that.
Mark Mothersbaugh.
And so it was at that point, it's like we couldn't go back. They'd already printed the cover. So now we had this mutilated potato face for an album cover. And it didn't really look like the handsome Chi Chi anymore, so I'm sure he was quite surprised when he got a box of them in the mail.
All our efforts were in fact in earnest, but what it looked like in the end is that Devo had meanly tricked Chichi Rodriguez and put out something that made him look hideous. It was, you know, it was a mess.
Although, along with the records, Warner Brothers sent Chichi a check for $2,500, so it wasn't a total loss for him. The band was never in touch with Chichi again, except he did send Mark Mothersbaugh a couple of publicity shots of himself saying, if you want to use more pictures of me, use these. And now it's almost 40 years later, and a few questions still remain. I really want to know if Chichi ever listened to that record and what he thought of it.
Yeah, that would be the big question. Well, why don't you interview Chichi Rodriguez?
Hello.
Hello, Chichi Rodriguez?
Yeah, who's this?
It's Sean Cole. I reached Chichi at a country club, naturally, in West Palm Beach, Florida. He's 81 now, still handsome, still plays golf now and then, not professionally, does a lot of philanthropic work through his foundation and an annual charity event. It's really an honor to talk to you.
It's my honor to talk to you, Johnny.
It's Sean, but that's okay. Chichi remembers his manager getting the letter from Devo, his manager who was also from Akron, Ohio, so there was a connection there, and he says yes, he did ask for a box of records, and he did hand them out to his friends and family. Did you notice when you got the record that it didn't quite look like you that much?
Well, it looked like me. I look at the pluses. It looked like me a little bit. At least the hat looked like me.
He didn't seem to know anything about all the mishigas that went down at Warner Brothers. Didn't know at all that they were worried he would sue them.
Sue them? Well, anybody that worry about somebody suing them, that means that they're so crooked that they sue people and they think that people are going to sue them. I thought it was these young people trying to make a career out of it, and I could help them, and that's it. Because I like to do something good every day of my life, and I want to leave the earth better than I found it.
So even young sort of avant-garde punk musicians you want to help?
Yeah.
Did you listen to that record?
Yeah, I listened to it one time.
Just once?
I put it away.
You didn't like it?
No, I didn't like it. I liked Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole and Dean Martin, who was my favorite, you know? Because music is not supposed to rile you up. Music is something to bring you down.
So that's that big question answered. But there was a second big question that I'd had this entire time, which was, what did Chichi think about his face, or a mutated version thereof, being on the cover of an apocalyptic weirdo art rock band's first album? Like, did that make any sense to him? And it did in the end. Because, of course, Chichi knows he's Chichi, knows how much he stands out, how outlandish and likable he is. None of that is lost on him. In fact, it's purposeful.
Golf is show business, and when you're on stage, you got to give the people a show.
Mm.
And that's what Devo did. Devo came out and gave the people a good time.
So that is the similarity between you and Devo?
Yes.
So in a way, it really makes sense that they used you on the cover of their record.
I think they were geniuses. And it takes a genius to recognize another.
One could argue that...
Again, Jerry Casale.
What we were put through by David Berman actually achieved something here better than just using a found image.
So what you're saying is corporate interference plus the faces of four American presidents who prosecuted the Vietnam War and its aftermath and this wonderfully dandy-ish golf legend, all of those together.
Yeah.
It's more Devo than the original Chichi image.
That's what I'm saying. It's Devo in action. Like, do you need an example of what we're talking about? Here it is.
And in possibly the most diabolical Devo twist of all, Jerry Casale, he's a big golf fan these days. Watches it on TV all the time.
One, two, three, skip!
That's reporter Sean Cole. We first aired that story back in August of 2017. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef. Traceability so bold that customers can even know the genetic pedigree of their steak or burger. From a six-generation family ranch in the Nebraska Sandhills, Honest Beef is dedicated to telling the story of your beef. Follow along on Instagram to see their life on the ranch, working to provide their customers with high-quality, dry-aged beef that they can feel great about. From their ranch to your door, they'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
In the Trump era, the news moves faster than ever, and the NPR Politics podcast is there to keep you informed. Every time there's a major political story, we get our best correspondents together to sort through the noise. The NPR Politics podcast, what you need to know right after it happens.
I'm Karen Given. In 2017, for the first time ever, some NBA teams wore sponsors' logos on their jerseys. None of those sponsorships saved a team from bankruptcy. But only a game's Gary Wallach has the story of a deal that did, sort of.
Heinz Weifenbach was a successful real estate developer who loved ice hockey. In 1981, he bought ECD Iserlohn, a team in Germany's elite Bundesliga. The team was not very good, and it was millions of dollars in debt. Ice hockey wasn't exactly Germany's favorite sport. Over the next few years, Weifenbach sank money into the team, and by 1986, ECD Iserlohn was a playoff contender. That endeared him to Iserlohn's small but loyal group of hockey fans, and to his players.
Heinz Weifenbach, he was a character.
That's Earl Spry, one of the many former ECD Iserlohn players from Canada.
Big, heavyset guy. He always had his big, long leather coat on, and he almost looked like a guy out of the Gestapo, Hogan Searles or something, and his long, wavy hair and a walrus mustache. You know, that was Heinz.
Weifenbach's dream was for his team to win the league championship, and he let his players know about it. And one time, one of his players fired back, crudely. During a game early in the 1987-1988 season, Iserlohn was losing 6-0 to a team it should have been beating. Defenseman Dan Olsen says Heinz walked into the locker room during the first intermission.
He was giving us the gears about how we were playing, and then he said, if you guys continue to play this way, I'm going to shoot you guys, as he pulled his gun out.
Most of the players knew Heinz was joking, but the team's top scorer, Danny Held, was not amused.
Told him if he ever pulled that thing out again, he was going to shove his stick up his butt and he wouldn't be able to breathe. I think he was a little scared of Danny Held.
But Heinz was probably more afraid of his creditors, according to Iserlohn forward Bruce Hardy.
He always carried a gun with him, wherever he went.
Like many of Germany's elite pro hockey teams of the mid-1980s, ECD Iserlohn was always looking for more sponsors, even though its uniforms were covered with logos. Again, Dan Olsen.
We had a beer company, Iserlohner Pilsner. One of our major sponsors owned a crystal company, Ritzenhof Crystal. BMW was one of our sponsors as well. I think that was on our helmets.
But all those sponsorships didn't generate enough income to pay the bills. The team also owed about $3.5 million in back taxes. By the fall of 1987, Heinz Weifenbach was desperate to keep his team solvent. Journalist Gabriel Luis Manga says that led Weifenbach to hire some expert help.
Heinz's personal tax man. They called him Merlin the Magician.
Players were getting paid for the most part, but Germany's central tax office was not. Officials knew that ECD Iserlohn was playing games with its ledgers. They just weren't exactly sure how. So they went after the players.
They're young Canadian guys in their 20s. They're just trying to continue a dream. They're having success. They're getting paid to do what they love. And then all of a sudden, the tax authorities are at their doors going through their apartments.
Bruce Hardy was good at sneaking out a back window when the feds came calling. But one day, they caught up with him.
They took my football, my baseball glove, my leather jacket, a TV. And right at that time in 87, the Looney came out and my brother had brought me one over.
The Looney is a Canadian $1 coin bearing the image of a loon. It's made mostly of nickel with a shiny bronze plating. In 1987, it was worth about 67 U.S. cents.
And they thought it was a piece of gold. They took it, too.
German tax officials were also looking for documents that might show them how Weifenbach was hiding income from them. The team responded by warning players to misplace their pay stubs and bank statements. The German government tightened the screws even more.
There's times when we'd come out of the rink and our cars would be taken away. They'd have a big trailer out there loading our cars up on them and take them away.
The finance people locked all the doors to the dressing room and told us we weren't allowed to practice and we weren't going to be allowed to play again until some of this money was paid back.
But the team needed to play to avoid bankruptcy, and Weifenbach couldn't stonewall the feds forever. He looked far and wide for creative financing, maybe a really big sponsorship deal. He reached out to Hans Meyer, the mayor of the nearby town of Hamer. Again, Gabriel Luis Manga.
Hans was notorious for his business dealings behind the Eastern Bloc in China, and so he was the kind of guy who could get help through some interesting business partners.
Burgermeister Meyer had in mind one very interesting partner.
Hans Meyer goes, "I've got it. We're going to call out Muammar Gaddafi."
Muammar Gaddafi, known sponsor of international terrorism. The man who ordered the 1986 bombing of a Berlin discotheque that killed three and wounded more than 200. Oppressor of millions of Libyans. Dictator of the country that supplied most of Germany's oil.
And so Heinz, he says, "Great, make the call. Let's go talk to Gaddafi."
Heinz jetted to Tripoli in late November of 1987.
And there's this whole spectacle of getting off the plane on the tarmac in Libya. And there's dancers and Bedouin tents, classic Gaddafi party. Heinz is wining and dining with Gaddafi. Gaddafi says, "You know, we don't have ice here, but I've seen hockey, and, you know, it seems like people like hockey in Germany, and Gaddafi likes anything that pleases the public. He's a man of the people."
Not really. Gaddafi was reviled in Libya, Germany, and elsewhere. But that didn't deter Heinz Weifenbach.
Heinz goes to Gaddafi's compound that's been bombed.
The U.S. had bombed Tripoli in 1986 in retaliation for the Berlin bombing. Two of the dead there had been U.S. soldiers.
And Gaddafi gives him a contract for almost $1 million to save the team.
Heinz returned to Germany and met with the players. He told them,
"Hey guys, guess what? Good news. The tax authorities aren't going to be raiding your apartments anymore. You might even get your leather coats and your loonies and your baseball gloves back. And we're going to be playing and we're going to get a shot to win the championship."
Heinz presented the team with their new jerseys. They were Iserlohn's familiar blue and white design, minus the Ritzenhof crystal logo on the front.
It just had this great big green book on the front of it. It said "Das Grüne Buch" in German, which meant the green book, and M. Gaddafi on it.
Gaddafi's Green Book had first been published 12 years earlier, in 1975.
He said all we had to do was wear Muammar's advertisement of his Green Book for 5 or 6 games, then we would get the money. So we kind of looked around the room at each other and a little bit aghast that Muammar Gaddafi was going to be our major sponsor.
And we're kind of going, wow, this is some crazy stuff going on here.
Hardy, Olsen, and Spry say they had no idea what was in Gaddafi's Green Book. And they really didn't care, at least not at first. They were hockey players, and hockey players just want to play hockey. But why would Muammar Gaddafi want to advertise on the uniforms of German hockey players?
Gaddafi had ambitions beyond just being the leader of Libya.
Daniel Calder is an expert in the literature of dictators.
He had global ambitions very early on, and he declared the arrival of the third universal theory that was going to replace communism and capitalism. He says that capitalism doesn't work, democracy is a fraud, socialism likewise. So this is the solution to the global problem of how to organize and govern a society.
But how did Gaddafi think that would work?
Yeah, so, you know, he was kind of sparse on the details. I don't think he thought about it that heavily. It's a tricky book to read because it's quite rambling and it doesn't maintain a very clear argument.
Among the Green Book's gems are Gaddafi's creative analogy between nationalism and gaseous stars and his lengthy list of the biological differences between men and women. And he shares his contempt for sports fans. He says,
"The thousands who crowd stadiums to view, applaud, and laugh are those foolish people who have failed to carry out the activity themselves."
Gaddafi enforced the study of the Green Book at various centers around Libya.
You can imagine sitting in a classroom in Libya or a university, and this is presented to you, and woe betide the person who laughed at these kind of bizarre statements.
And here's where a German pro ice hockey team comes in.
He was still trying to find ways to reach the world. Because he had the home audience sewn up, he didn't have to worry about them. But clearly that wasn't enough.
On December 4th, 1987, ECD Iserlohn took the ice in their home arena against Rosenheim SB. Bruce Hardy and his teammates wore their brand new Green Book jerseys. Fans had found out about the new sponsorship beforehand.
People are going wild, dressed up as Gaddafi in sort of Bedouin garb.
And it was just electric in there, and I'm going, wow, this is changing things here real quick.
6,000 spectators had somehow been crammed into an arena with a capacity of only 4,900. Iserlohn won the game. It looked like Weifenbach might finally get his first championship. And now everybody was paying attention, including international news media. It seemed to the players that all the publicity was good publicity. But Heinz was fighting with the German Ice Hockey Federation, which wanted to nix the Green Book sponsorship. And then, for its next game, ECD Iserlohn traveled to Frankfurt, where thousands of U.S. troops were stationed. When the team bus pulled up to the arena, Dan Olsen looked out the window.
We were met with a hostile mob of people, and, you know, they all had their signs, and they thought that we were devils for playing for this guy and advertising his book.
Before the game, the commander of an anti-terrorism unit told Earl Spry,
"You know, we've had bomb threats, and we've gone through the whole rink, and we found nothing. We've got dogs and everything. Pretty sure it's safe, but we can't guarantee anything."
In the locker room, the players told Heinz that they had serious doubts about wearing the Green Book logo.
And Heinz said, "Listen, guys, if you don't wear the jerseys, the money is not going to come through and the season's going to be canceled."
We just took a vote, and I think it was fairly unanimous. We just said, "No, we're not going to wear them." That was it.
The team told Heinz about their decision.
He just kind of looked at us and he went, "Okay." Then he walked out of the room.
He was disappointed because, you know, I mean, he wanted to keep that team together. He wanted to keep his butt out of jail too, right? So,
on December 6, 1987, ECD Iserlohn played in its old jerseys. Gaddafi withheld payment, and the team declared bankruptcy a few days later. The team was dissolved. Heinz was crushed. So were hockey fans in Iserlohn. But Earl Spry wasn't.
To be honest with you, I was relieved that it ended. I was sad for the fans, but I wanted to go someplace and just concentrate on my hockey and get that behind me, put it in my past.
Heinz Weifenbach managed to dodge German tax officials long enough to resurface as chairman of Sauerland ECD, a team in Germany's third-tier ice hockey league. Sauerland won a title in 1989. Weifenbach's championship dream had finally been realized. He resigned 2 years later. 2 years after that, he began serving a 27-month prison sentence for tax evasion. He died in early 2015. Libyans were unburdened of Gaddafi's regime in 2011. Daniel Calder says that was more or less the end of the Green Book.
There was nobody saying, "Oh, let's hang on to the Green Book. It contains truth." This is common with a lot of regimes. These books are there, and then they're just... It's like people don't even want to revile them. They just want to forget them.
Only two Green Book jerseys are known to have survived. One is in the German Ice Hockey Hall of Fame in Augsburg. The other lives in one of Bruce Hardy's closets. He doesn't take it out very often.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. That story first aired in July of last year. Daniel Calder's book is titled The Infernal Library, on dictators, the books they wrote, and other catastrophes of literacy. If you'd like to make sure you never miss a second of Only a Game, there's no need to throw a Hail Mary. All you need to do is go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. Easy peasy, like a short curl root. We'll be right back with one more Hail Mary. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
While you're sleeping, a whole bunch of news is happening around the world. Up first is the NPR News podcast that gets you caught up on the big news in a small amount of time. Spend about 10 minutes with Up First on weekday mornings from NPR News.
I'm Karen Given. D'Artagnan Crockett's early life was bleak. His mother died when he was 8 years old. His father was an addict. By the time D'Artagnan was a sophomore in high school, he was sleeping on friends' couches. And, oh yeah, D'Artagnan is legally blind.
Being a black kid in the inner city with physical limitations, or what people call a disability, you're already written off. No one expects much from you. You're basically useless. And I wasn't in a position where I could fix that.
D'Artagnan couldn't change his circumstances, so he did the only thing he could. He tried to hide them. D'Artagnan's severely nearsighted, but he has just enough sight to get by. So he pretended he could see. He joined his high school wrestling team and didn't even tell the coaches.
They had no idea. I was looking at something and I was having a hard time seeing it. It was like, what's going on there? I'm like, oh, I'm visually impaired. The coach was like, you what? I didn't want them to know.
D'Artagnan didn't want the coaches to treat him any differently, so they didn't. Then one day, during senior year, Leroy Sutton joined the wrestling team at Lincoln West High School in Cleveland. D'Artagnan was one of the team captains, and he wasn't the least bit worried that his team's new recruit was missing something. Well, two somethings.
We were talking in the cafeteria, and I asked him what happened to his legs. And he told me that, yeah, I was run over by a train. And I laughed. Like one of those deep belly laughs. You'd always heard the, oh my God, oh, I'm so sorry, oh, how'd that happen? Just to see someone not feeling sorry for him just kind of sparked a bond almost instantly.
Good thing, because when the bus showed up on a snowy day to take the team to their first wrestling match of the season, it wasn't wheelchair accessible.
I told him, like, hey, jump in my bag. We'll do this.
Soon, D'Artagnan was carrying Leroy on and off buses, up and down stairs and into the bleachers. Leroy weighed about 170 pounds, but D'Artagnan didn't think much of it. He certainly didn't think it would change his life.
It was just helping out a friend, which, I mean, who wouldn't?
But there was something Leroy Sutton didn't know about D'Artagnan Crockett.
Nah, I didn't know he was blind. I found out in class. I noticed he was, like, really close to the book that we were reading. So I was like, all right, yeah, it's problem seeing. So I turned to a couple of the other students around me, and I was like, hey, man, let's do this, like, a project style and, you know, read out loud.
And that's probably how things would have stayed. D'Artagnan and Leroy helping each other out, both thinking it was no big deal. If not for an ESPN features producer named Lisa Finn and her dad. Early one morning in February of 2009, Lisa's dad called. He woke her up and told her to check out a story in the Cleveland Plain Dealer.
And there was a photograph of two high school wrestlers. One of them was riding on the back of the other because he had no legs. I was just completely in awe of this photograph. There was just something about the expression on Leroy's face in particular.
Lisa rushed to work to convince her boss, his name was Victor, to send her to Cleveland right away to film Leroy and D'Artagnan in what was likely to be their last high school wrestling match. And all she had was this photograph.
He said something to the effect of, are they good wrestlers? And I said, probably not, knowing the high school that they went to. Are they friends? Kind of looks like it. One's on the other's back. Are they articulate? Victor, I said, look at this picture. Like, it's the one who can't walk being carried by the one who can't see. And Victor's a good man. And he just looked at me and said, have a nice trip to Cleveland.
Lisa headed to the airport. She had already packed a bag. During the drive, she found a camera crew that could meet her in Cleveland and called the school. She arrived during warm-ups. But before she could introduce herself to Leroy and D'Artagnan, she was stopped by their coach.
He said, hey, you the ESPN lady? And I said, yes, I am. And I extended my hand, introduced myself, and he playfully slapped it away. And he leaned in and looked me in the eye. And he said, you have been sent here by God. You know that? He said, did you hear me? He said, you've been sent here by God today. And he said this year he'd been praying really hard for D'Artagnan and for Leroy, because he felt once they graduate, the world had nothing for kids like them.
D'Artagnan was excited to talk to Lisa. He told me he felt it was about time that someone noticed him for something he was doing right. But Leroy just put in his earbuds and stared at the floor.
I was so surprised. In 13 years, the first time I'd ever been with an amateur athlete or a teenager who was not excited to see ESPN.
What Lisa didn't know yet, but would find out later, is that when Leroy was run over by a train on his way to school at the age of 11, the local paper followed him for a year and ran a 6-page spread under the headline, Comeback Kid. The paper didn't mention some of the things their reporters must have seen, that Leroy's mom wasn't taking him to his physical therapy appointments or even making sure he made it to school. She was spending his disability checks on drugs.
So I was like, whatever, I'm not trying to be in the spotlight or not trying to get any, pity or praise for being in the chair. You know, it's my life.
Lisa knew that if she wanted to tell this story, she'd need Leroy's help. So she asked a coach, the one who had told her she was sent by God, to go with her to visit Leroy at his grandmother's house. Leroy was sitting on the floor of his basement room playing video games. And again, he wouldn't even look at her.
So for about an hour, I just made conversation with his coach and we left. I went back by myself the next night. Again, I sat beside him on the floor this time, and again, he wouldn't speak to me. Not any more than a grunt, anyway. I asked a few questions. And so I left. I came back a third night, same thing. And on the fourth night, I said to him, Leroy, I want to thank you for letting me visit you these last 4 days. I can tell it's not easy for you, so I'm not going to come back. But I think somewhere deep inside you have a lot to say. And I think it's probably important.
She was like, if, you know, you want to tell your story, or even if you just want to talk to me as a friend, then I'll be here for you.
My heart was really heavy as I went up the stairs because I feared that if I left, no one may ever find him again. But as I got to the front door, I heard him coming up the stairs and he called out to me and he just sort of gruffly said,
hey, I got this new game. You wanna see it? And then she watched me play a game.
It felt really good. Not because I had won anything, but because I know how difficult it is for trauma victims to trust. And he certainly didn't fully trust me, but he was willing to take a chance.
So Lisa set out to tell Leroy and D'Artagnan's story for ESPN. She interviewed her subjects and researched their backgrounds. She maintained proper journalistic distance from the two teenagers, even though she did buy them dinner at Subway after their shoots. Until one day when she discovered that she couldn't be just an observer anymore. It was at the conference powerlifting championships.
D'Artagnan was in the process of winning the whole thing when he went to the bleachers to rest, I guess.
Actually, people were saying how stuff was stolen, and we went over to check, and a lot of our things were stolen.
So his wallet, his ID, his phone, his duffel bag, everything he had.
I even had my social security card in it because I didn't know where else to put it.
And he went into a full-on rage, like where he looked capable of violence.
I completely went ballistic. Because when you grow up with nothing and you have nothing, having something stolen from you is a huge thing.
Lisa offered to help D'Artagnan replace his things, and D'Artagnan accepted, but she'd need cash. So she turned to her cameraman, his name was Cameron, and asked if she could borrow some money.
And he kind of rolled his eyes at me and let out a big sigh, and he said, go save the turtles.
Turtles. Okay, hang with me here. Lisa was about to do something journalists aren't supposed to do. She was going to affect the outcome of her story. And that's not a good idea for the story, for the reporter, and sometimes even for the people being interviewed. But here's the thing. Have you ever found yourself watching a video and something really awful is happening and no one is doing anything to stop it? For Cameron, it was watching nature films about baby sea turtles trying to survive their short walk from the sand to the sea.
And Cameron said, and then it hits you. Sea turtles would not be endangered if the cameraman would just pick them up and throw them in the ocean. And he said, these boys wouldn't be struggling if we helped them. So go, go, cross that sacred line of journalistic ethics. Here's $200. Go save the turtles.
Lisa shot 120 hours of video, about 100 hours more than is normal. She spent 2 months editing. That's a job that usually takes just 2 weeks. ESPN aired the story in August of 2009.
At Lincoln West High School in Cleveland, senior wrestlers D'Artagnan Crockett and Leroy Sutton are a team of their own, inseparable, joined together at more than the hip.
Leroy called D'Artagnan as soon as the story had aired.
The conversation was just, dude, I know, right? Yeah.
It was just grunts and dudes. It was very short.
Because, I mean, there was nothing else that we needed to say. Because everything was said in the story. We both just understood that it was powerful.
D'Artagnan and Leroy didn't yet know how much power was in their story, but Lisa was starting to find out.
Whew. I had spent that whole edit period sort of praying that just one person would see it and want to help them. And that was a really small prayer, because within minutes of the story airing, I was started getting 2-3 emails a minute from people who saw it and wanted to help.
Soon, there was money for college, so Lisa helped Leroy and D'Artagnan make it through their entrance exams and college applications. She took them shopping for school supplies. Leroy moved to Phoenix to study video game development at Collins College of Design, and D'Artagnan attended school in Colorado while training with a Paralympic judo team in Colorado Springs. Lisa thought her job was done, but it was just beginning.
You know, I had put them on television as these resilient sort of action figure hero friends that I saw and that I believed they still were. But now I was dealing with essentially preteens in terms of the life skills that they had.
Leroy and D'Artagnan struggled in school. Lisa had them both tested and found that their skills were far below grade level. Lisa taught them how to write up a budget, but they still ran out of money almost as soon as it was deposited in their bank accounts. To hear Leroy and D'Artagnan tell it, it wasn't that bad. Leroy says the schoolwork was easy. It was just the organizational skills he was lacking. And D'Artagnan admits that training with the Paralympic team was stressful, but it was nothing like the stress of wondering where he'd be sleeping the next night. But everyone agrees that the stakes were high.
They needed to stay afloat because there was no plan B. They had nowhere to go back to. They had no family to go back to. They had no saving account to fall back on. They had no education to fall back on. It broke my heart.
Slowly, things started to improve. D'Artagnan figured out how to get to practice on time. And somehow, just 2 years after arriving at the Olympic Training Center, he qualified to compete in judo at the London Paralympics.
I started 2 years late. Reality, I started 18 years too late. And so the idea of me making a Paralympic team just seemed sort of impossible.
Lisa and Leroy flew to London to cheer D'Artagnan on. And then?
He did it. It was amazing.
He won the bronze.
He did.
And what was that moment like?
Well, now you're going to make me cry. It was unbelievable. And I say this a lot, but it was like watching this boy who had spent his life largely forgotten by this world. As his coach said, nothing for him in this life. And now he was standing on the top of a Paralympic podium with a medal around his neck. It was just one of the most stirring, powerful, redemptive images I have ever witnessed.
The USOC gives American medal winners the opportunity to give a medal to the person they feel is most responsible for getting them to the podium. It's called the Order of Ecos, and it's supposed to go to a coach.
I, of course, gave it to Lisa. There was no one else to consider.
He hung this medal around my neck and gave me a big hug and thanked me for all I had done. That was a moment of love.
It felt really great to see how appreciative and grateful she was to receive an award or gift, whatever you want to call it, from me.
Back home in Phoenix, Leroy was struggling. His girlfriend had given birth to his daughter, but the stresses of school and finances and being a dad were too much for him. He was diagnosed with PTSD. Leroy saw a therapist for a while, but then he decided that he didn't want to talk to a stranger. He wanted to talk to Lisa.
What he needed most in that moment was, again, just as I did in the basement 3 years prior, someone to sit beside him and wait and listen.
Things started to look up for Leroy. He would eventually graduate from college and get a job as a video game tester. Yes, he plays video games for a living. But before all that, he started a tradition. In May of 2013, he wrote Lisa a letter for Mother's Day. When I asked him why he did it, it was almost like he didn't understand why I needed to ask.
Because she feels like my mom. It's like, hey, she deserves this. See, I did it.
That letter is printed in Lisa's book. I was hoping Leroy would read it out loud for me, and he said he had a copy on his phone.
Nope, that one's not on my phone. I have the one from this year, though.
Can you read some of that to me? Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah. Actually, it's kind of weird, so I could email it to you. Yeah, I could email it to you.
I thought Leroy was hesitating because he didn't want to share something so personal. This is the guy who made Lisa sit, staring at him, while he played video games for 4 consecutive nights before he'd even speak to her. So I was surprised when it showed up in my inbox just a few minutes later. It's a poem, and part of it goes like this. When I first met you, those were dark days. In that time, I was stuck in my dark way. There was no light, so you set the world ablaze. But now these days, I'm full of smile, full of play. Hope you feel loved today. So I take this moment to say, thank you, Mom. I love you.
I had never gone through these things with Leroy and D'Artagnan expecting a thank you or acknowledgement. It wasn't why I was in this. You know, when people ask me what surprises me about our story, I say it's that they loved me back.
Since that story first aired in September of 2016, D'Artagnan Crockett won a second Olympic bronze medal at the Rio Games. In the fall of 2018, he retired from the sport and is now in the final year of his sociology degree. Leroy Sutton is still working in the gaming industry. Lisa Fenn has recently set up a GoFundMe account to help Leroy and D'Artagnan with healthcare expenses and to, quote, permanently break their generational cycles of poverty. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Lisa's book about her friendship with D'Artagnan and Leroy is called Carry On. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our intern is Arlo Moore Bloom. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.